Hello, you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 28th. I'm Amanda Pavaza from Drake University, and here's our first story. All right, our first story today is titled Crisis Care Anywhere Launched to Address Youth Mental Health by David Golbitz of the Nonpareil, and there's a photo above it with the Children's Square USA Chief Program Officer Jonathan Holland speaking to guests during a Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce ribbon-cutting ceremony celebrating the renovation of Children's Square's Children Emergency Shelter on Friday, October 7th, 2022. Over the past decade, the number of children and adolescents suffering from mental health crisis, feeling of sadness and hopelessness, or suicidal ideation has increased by 40%. That reality, quantified by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has led mental health professionals to look for a new way to intervene sooner when a crisis arises. About 1 in 10 children are dealing with some kind of mental health issue, a diagnosable mental health issue, and that number is only expected to rise as we come out of the aftermath of COVID and just dealing with a higher kind of stress environment, Children's Square Chief Program Officer Jonathan Holland told the Nonpareil in a recent interview. With those rising numbers in mind, Children's Square unveiled a new program called Crisis Care Anywhere at the beginning of the month to help families with children who may be experiencing a significant mental health crisis that would not require them to be hospitalized. This program specifically works to intervene with kids that are having severe anxiety or panic attacks, some kind of acute depression, suicidal thoughts or behaviors, severe mood swings, or under intense emotional distress, Holland said. Crisis Care Anywhere fills a need in the mental health care system for adolescents. This program is specifically for those kids that are in crisis situations that it can't necessarily be addressed in a timely fashion through an outpatient therapy program or something like that, but may not be acute enough, may not be as extreme as needing hospitalization, Holland said. Before the service, children and teens could receive therapy, or if the situation was severe enough, they could go to the hospital. But there was really kind of this gap where you could still be in a crisis but not eligible for admission into the hospital. So that's where we come in, Holland said. After a family contacts Children's Square about a child's mental health crisis, staff will meet with the child and family for an average of 5 to 7 days on campus, at their home, or elsewhere in the community where they feel comfortable, such as a Starbucks or a library. The meetings focus on helping to build skills to manage behavior, provide coordination for mental health treatment, and learn how to access the services in the community that provide mental health services. The therapy is really individually based on the need of that specific person, but it's all crisis response. So whatever they're dealing with, we would tailor a plan. Then they would meet with that therapy provider each day they're enrolled in that program, Holland said. Another key component to the program is that they work with other mental health professionals, not necessarily a therapist, but trained professionals that will work with them and work with them on skill building, managing emotions, dealing with difficult concepts, and how to overcome certain issues, Holland continued. Holland also clarified that Crisis Care Anywhere is not a mobile response unit that will come straight to your home after you call. We're going to work with you and the family to make sure that we find a time that works for everybody, but it could be up to 18 hours after initial contact is made before we actually are able to get in and work with the kids, Holland said. The program is the first phase of Crisis Care Anywhere program. For the next phase, Children's Square is working on creating a residential stay program, for kids that may not be comfortable in a home or family may feel like a change in scenery might help, Holland said. We're working towards having that open and having up to 6 beds or so for kids that are in crisis mode to come decompress, to work with that therapist for 5 to 7 days, and then work on their discharge plan and what they're going to do after they go home, Holland said. Holland expects the residential part of the program will be ready by early summer. If your child or teenager is having mental health crisis or just want to learn more about Crisis Care Anywhere, call 712-828-7458, which is available 24/7. All right, our next story this morning is titled Reynolds Signs Off on AEA Changes by Aaron Murphy. Significant changes to the funding and operations of Iowa's 9 area education agencies that provide support to schools, plus an increase in state school funding and a boost in teacher pay, were signed into law Wednesday by Governor Kim Reynolds. The area education agency changes reflect a goal set out by Reynolds during her condition of the state address nearly 3 months ago. However, what she signed into law is a stripped-down version of what she originally proposed after a strong backlash from advocates for special education and AEAs. During a bill signing ceremony in her formal office at the Iowa Capitol, The Republican governor said the new law will improve special education for students with disabilities and called the changes meaningful and necessary reform. She said while the AEA system works well for some students, that hasn't been the experience for all students. Some schools haven't used some of the AEA services despite being forced to pay for them. Others have felt that they didn't receive quality that they expect, Reynolds said. And many schools, urban and rural, large and small, have raised concern about a lack of transparency regarding the cost of AEA services. Democrats vehemently opposed the changes to Iowa's area education agencies, arguing from the start that significant alterations were unnecessary. Representative Jennifer Converse, D. Windsor Heights, who leads a minority party in the House against criticized Reynolds and Republicans for approving the legislation. When you look at the celebration Reynolds is having, I want you to think about the families who have so much uncertainty now as they're wondering what will happen to the AEA services in their communities, what will happen to their kids who are getting AEA services. There's so many questions, Converse said. So what the new law will do, the Iowa Senate passed a compromise proposal Tuesday that will put forward the Iowa House last week, and the new law will increase state funding for Iowa's K through 12 public schools by 2.5% in the next school year, which is a $119 million increase for a total of $3.8 billion, according to the state's nonpartisan legislative services agency. It will also raise the minimum salary for a first-year public school teacher in Iowa from the current $33,500 to $47,500 in the 2024-2025 school year, and $50,000 the next year, and set a minimum salary for teachers with at least 12 years of experience to $60,000 in the upcoming school year and $62,000 the following year. It will budget $22 million in the upcoming school year and $23 million in the next year to address other veteran teachers' salaries, and $14 million to help boost the pay of educational support staff like para-ed teachers. Many operational and funding changes to the area education agencies keep some funding for special education and other education and media services with school districts instead of sending the funds directly to AEAs, and moves special education oversight from the AEAs to the State Education Department, and create a task force to study and recommend future changes. AEA changes in the law. Area education agencies oversee education of Iowa students with disabilities and offer media and consulting services to schools and students in their boundaries. Currently, federal and state special education funding goes directly to the 9 agencies. AEAs also receive property tax funding for media services and other education services for schools in their region. Once the new law is fully implemented in the school year, 10% of state funding for special education services will remain with the school districts for them to use, while 90% will continue to flow directly to the AEAs. In the second year, all state funding for other education services and media services will go directly to schools, which could use that money for AEA services or get them from another entity directly. The law also creates a division in the Iowa Department of Education, up to 53 new full-time equivalent positions, to provide oversight of the special education services provided by the AEAs. AEA debate reaches conclusion. Reynolds proposed to overhaul the agencies, a system created 5 decades ago by lawmakers, drew strong opposition from educators and parents of students with disabilities who worry it will hurt special education in the state. Most school superintendents also expressed opposition, although some said they are in favor of having more control of their special education dollars. The final proposal was the result of weeks negotiation between Reynolds and the majority Republicans in the House and Senate and discussions with the AEA officials and school superintendents. While this bill has been the focus of much discussion and debate, it has also presented opportunities for insightful conversations and meaningful compromise, Reynolds said. When it comes to legislation that offers so much potential for the future of our state, I appreciate knowing that there's a willingness to keep the lines of communication open and to continue to work together to reach a compromise. That took place from the very beginning of the session, and I think we ended in a really good place. The compromise House File 2612 was approved by only Republican lawmakers. All Democrats and some Republicans voted against the overall bill because of their objections to the AEA provisions. Democrats said they also opposed the 2.5% school funding measure, saying it is insufficient. They expressed the support for the teacher pay boost and criticized Republicans for combining the provisions into one bill. The reason teacher pay was included in the final package is to hold teacher pay hostage and so that they can do exactly what they're doing now, which is to say that some Democrats didn't vote for teacher pay, Conference told reporters. There was more wrong in this bill than there was right within this bill. Senator Ken Rosenboom, a Republican from Pella, chair of the Senate Education Committee, said that the new law will make changes to the AEAs that are modest and fair but necessary and will not threaten the viability of the AEA system. He said it will also add accountability and transparency that he says is currently lacking. The AEAs have done tremendous amount of good for many years in Iowa, and all of us are appreciative of that, Rosenboom said at the bill signing ceremony. As I've said many times, there are 1,000 bright stars in the AEA constellation, but if the world has changed since the AEAs were created in 1974, reform is needed. Representative Skylar Wheeler, a Republican from Hull, who managed the bill in the House, has a 5-year-old daughter with autism who receives special education from an AEA, said superintendents, school board members, teachers, private school officials, and parents of students with disabilities were all involved in discussions with lawmakers during the legislative process. We are improving on a system that we will see increase in outcomes from in our students, Wheeler said. Senate Minority Leader Pam Jochim, a Democrat from Dubuque, issued a statement thanking what she said were thousands of Iowans who expressed their opposition to the AEA changes. Parents, educators, students, and community leaders changed the course of this legislation, Jochim said in the statement. They prevented Republican politicians from fast-tracking this bill and exposed Governor Reynolds' misplaced priorities. The major changes in the new law will go into effect on July 1st. All right, our next story is titled, Proposal Sets High Bar for Tax Increases by Kayla McCullough. Iowa can get a direct vote on the state's income tax policy under a pair of constitutional amendments making their way through the state legislature. On Tuesday, Iowa House Republicans passed a resolution to add an amendment to the Iowa Constitution requiring a 2/3 majority of the legislature to increase income taxes on individuals and corporations. The bill, House Joint Resolution 2006, passed the House 6135 on a party line vote. Another resolution in the Senate, which has advanced out of the committee and is eligible for a vote in the full chamber, would require a flat individual income tax in the state, prohibiting a progressive tax system that imposes a higher rate on higher earners. Both chambers are expected to pass the resolution, said Representative Bobby Kaufman of Wilton, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. The two initially started as one resolution, but Kaufman said they were split up to avoid confusion on the ballot. If approved by voters, the amendments would enshrine Iowa's Republican tax-cutting agenda into the Constitution and make it far more difficult for future lawmakers to raise taxes. The proposals will need to clear a few more hurdles to be added to the state's Constitution. Constitutional amendments must be passed in multiple years by two separate General Assemblies, and then they are placed on the ballot and if subject to a popular vote. If the amendment gains majority approval from voters, it is added to the Constitution. This would be the first time the amendments pass the legislature. If they pass a second time, voters will likely see them on the ballot in 2026, Kaufman said. Several top Republican decision makers have set eliminating Iowa's income tax as a long-term goal. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said last year she hopes to reduce income tax to zero by the end of her term, which ends in 2026. The proposal passed by the House on Tuesday would require that 2/3 of each member in each chamber, 67 in the House and 34 in the Senate, agree on legislation that increases Iowa's income tax on individuals or corporations. Democrats have been critical of Republican efforts to lower income taxes in recent years, saying their tax cuts disproportionately benefit the wealthy and do not do enough to lower costs and living expenses for low-income Iowans. Democrats argued on Tuesday that constraining the ability of the legislature to increase taxes could backfire if the state experiences an economic downturn and lawmakers are not able to quickly respond and raise revenues for vital services. Adam Zabner, a Democrat from Iowa City, said that lawmakers are not able to raise income taxes when more revenue is needed. They will turn to other, more regressive taxes like sales tax. Lower-income people spend a higher portion of their income on sales tax than high earners. What this constitutional amendment does is to say the next time there's budget crunch, we're going to shift that burden onto the poorest Iowans, either by taking away services they rely on or increasing regressive taxes, Zabner said. Democrats also said the amendment elevated the short-term interest of Iowa Republicans without taking into account how the state could look in 50 or 100 years. The mark of good lawmaking is having that long-term vision because of we've been selected by the people of Iowa not only to take care of today, but to take care of generations that come after us, said Representative Austin Beth, a Democrat up from Des Moines. More than a dozen other states require a supermajority to pass some tax increases. Kaufman pointed to Democratic-led states that have similar rules in place, said that they have fared well even with the restriction. States have had those rules in place for decades and avoided consequences, Kaufman said. The sky did not fall. Every example of dystopian future did not happen, he said. There were no grave consequences. The resolution to require a flat tax in Iowa's constitution passed out of the Senate Tax Policy Committee on March 20th with only Republican support. The bill is eligible for a vote in full chamber. The resolution would require individual income taxes to be imposed at a single rate for all taxpayers. For now, Iowa has a progressive income tax system with brackets ranging from 4.4% to 5.7%. Under tax cuts Reynolds signed in 2022, the income tax will reach a flat 3.9% for all earners by 2026. Republican lawmakers are likely to speed that up that schedule this year, though no plan has been agreed to. Kaufman said they will likely set a flat tax that will take effect this year at a rate that keeps the state's revenue sustainable. If we can get down to 3.9% this year, we will, and I suspect there's a chance that we'll be closer to 4 or 4.1, he said. Reynolds has proposed a bill to set a flat 3.65% income tax this year and lower it to 3.5% in 2025. All right, our next story is titled Help Wanted Police, and this is a story from Philadelphia. And this story is by Brooke Schultz of the Associated Press. Faced with gaping vacancies in its police force and concerns about public safety, the Philadelphia Police Department had to think creatively about how to get more candidates in the door. The answer? Fewer push-ups. The city's move to lower requirements for the entry physical exam at its police academy is part of the broader effort nationally to reevaluate policies that keep law enforcement applicants out of the job pool amid a hiring crisis. To close the gap, policies on tattoos, previous drug use, physical fitness, and college credits are all being reconsidered. Los Angeles is offering housing subsidies. Other departments like Washington, D.C. are offering signing bonuses of more than $20,000. Several states have expanded eligibility to non-citizens, while others have changed the minimum age of officers to 18. A law signed by Pennsylvania's Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro at the end of the last year lowered the physical fitness requirements applicants are assessed on, from sit-ups to time distance running and push-ups in Philadelphia. The city buffeted with high crime rates and other big cities, like other big cities during the early pandemic, has struggled to fill vacancies in its police department. Under the new law, candidates can pass their exam at a lower threshold than previously required. Now in the 15th percentile of the standards, the force uses its test to cadets. Depending on your age and sex, it's the difference of about 3 to 5 sit-ups or push-ups or a few minutes added to the 1.5-mile run. Philadelphia has already seen the payoff of its amended fitness entry exam. Since the law took effect, 51% of people testing have passed, compared with 36 previously, said Captain John Walker, who handles recruitment for the department. Cadets still need to graduate by passing the current standard of being in the 30th percentile, but over the 9 months of training, it gives candidates time to grow, Walker said. Getting them in at a responsible, logical number gets us more people and better opportunities, he said. Megan Bortner was one of the 100 out of 265 cadets who passed their exams during a recruitment event in February, and she is moving to the city after 4 years as an officer in Indiana, where she completed the same physical fitness exam as everyone else, regardless of gender and age. Applying for Philadelphia's force, Bortner, who is 33, had to complete the 1.5-mile run in under 20 minutes to pass the exam under the new entry standards. Previously, she would have had to do it in roughly 17 minutes. She thinks the lower threshold for entry helps more recruits have a chance at becoming officers, meaning a more diverse pool working in the community. If you're having self-doubts or you're not feeling as confident in your athletic abilities, I think this would be a great starting point, Bortner said. Concerns about crime and public safety have been top of mind for Philadelphians. It was a leading factor in the recent mayoral election, with voters choosing Democratic candidate Sherelle Parker, who vowed to be tough on crime and is pushing to hire hundreds more officers to walk the beat. The hope is to get more recruits hired to plug about 836 vacancies in the department faces in its 6,000 officer force. Combined with around 470 officers who aren't able to be on the street duty due to injuries, the department is well below the staffing levels it has the budget for. When evaluating their policies to try to bring on more cadets, officers saw the impact graduation-level physical fitness exam had. In 2024, they hope to hire a minimum of 350 recruits, 167% increase in personnel hired. We service a big demographic of the people. Bringing people in from all those demographics, I think, is critical, Walker said. By looking at these barriers to entry, teaching people there are opportunities, and listening to people who are testing, I think that's where policing needs to be. Mm-hmm. Departments small and large across the country are facing challenges, said Chuck Wexler, executive director for Police Executive Research Forum, a nonprofit policing think tank based in Washington, D.C. Officers are resigning or retiring at higher rates than applicants are becoming officers, he said. Even though more people are beginning to apply, there's still a gap. Had the hiring crisis had been far more pervasive than Wexler has seen before. Additional scrutiny applied to police officers in 2022 after the murder of George Floyd has had an impact on the amount of people who want the job, he said. Earlier this year in Pennsylvania, the governor removed a requirement for applicants to have at least 60 college credits to be a state trooper. Applications surged within a month, with nearly half of the aspiring cadets having been previously ineligible, the Pennsylvania State Police said. In Philadelphia, Tyler Durr, 29, was driven to become an officer because he wanted to be a public servant. After passing four phases of the physical exam, he said he found it easy. I think if anyone takes care of themselves as physically active, this should be pretty easy for them, he said, cautioning against lowering the standards too much. It was something Wexler cautioned, too. It only takes one bad officer to bring down a department and impact an entire city. We saw that in Minneapolis, he said. The one thing you can't make a mistake on is character. And for this article, there are some photos. So the one on the top is the Philadelphia Police Academy staff counting push-ups during applicants' physical fitness exam in February 24th. Another one is of some, it looks like, cadets running and doing their 1.5-mile run. Another picture below is they're counting sit-ups during their physical fitness exam. And a final picture is of a room of applicants warming up before their physical fitness exam. All right, our next story is from the business section, and it's titled Immigration Boosts U.S. Economy by Augusta Sarava and Enda Karan. While the rising number of immigrants in the U.S. has sowed division amongst politicians across the country and stoked angst amongst a swath of voters, there's one place where almost everyone seems on the same upbeat page: Wall Street. Last month, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office calculated that immigration will generate a $7 trillion boost to gross domestic product over the next decade. The agency came to that conclusion after incorporating the recent surge in immigration. The CBO release spurred a flurry of fresh numbered crunching among investment bank economists to account for the boost those newcomers are giving to the labor force and consumer spending. Goldman Sachs Group, Inc. revised its near-term economic growth forecast earlier this month. J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and BNP Paribas S.A. were among banks that acknowledged the economic impact from surging immigration in recent weeks. Immigration is not just a highly charged social and political issue. It's also a big macroeconomic one. Janet Henry, Global Chief Economist at HSBC Holdings, told clients recently. No advanced economy is benefiting from immigration quite like the U.S., and the impact of migration has been an important one of the U.S. growth story over the past 2 years. Morgan Stanley economist Sam Coffin and Ellen Zettner noted that this month, the faster population growth fueled by immigration lends itself to stronger employment and population estimates than initially thought, though added that the full effect may not be captured by official data. It's hard to pin down the exact scale of the inflows of foreign-born people thanks to many entering without visas or other documentation. But CBO statisticians incorporated data from U.S. Customs and Border Patrol to come up with their higher projected net immigration, according to Morgan Stanley analysis. Goldman estimates that immigration influx was about 2.5 million in 2023, a figure far above the 1.6 million implied by the change in foreign-born population in the official household survey from the Census Bureau. The positive tone among economists contradicts that seen on the campaign trail as a surge in the number of undocumented immigrants entering the U.S. through the southern border stokes political strife. The share of Americans who see immigration as the most important problem facing the U.S. now is matching a record high in data going back four decades, according to the recent Gallup poll. The recent boost from immigration as a result of both more legal immigrants as the U.S. goes through unprecedented visa backlogs and the surge in illegal border crossings. The nation's 32.5 million immigrant workers now account for roughly 1 in 5 U.S. workers, a record high in government data going back almost 2 decades. To be sure, the connection between the higher influx of foreign workers and the rapid post-pandemic recovery has been noted by economists and policymakers alike for some time now. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has repeatedly cited immigration as one of the reasons behind strong economic growth. In a reference to the role being played by higher labor supply, Powell pointed last week to a strong pace of immigration helping on that front. The overall picture is a strong labor market. The extreme imbalances we saw in the early parts of the pandemic recovery have mostly been resolved. You're seeing high job growth. You're seeing big increases in supply, Powell said at his press conference Wednesday. Federal policymakers lifted their growth forecast this year from 2.1% from 1.4%, their median estimate showed. Immigration has been important to the surprising pace of job growth, even alongside a modestly increasing unemployment rate, according to J.P. Morgan chief U.S. economist Michael Feroli. This, in turn, has been one factor behind surprisingly strong overall in income and output growth. While there are warnings that increased immigration will undercut wages and conditions in some industries, the unemployment rate rose to a 2-year high in February. Businesses are ramping up calls for changes to bring in more workers through legal channels. Almost 9 million positions are open across the economy, equal to 1.4 jobs for every job seeker. Foreign-born workers make up a record of 18.6% of the civilian workforce in 2023, and the U.S. approved a record number of work authorizations in the fiscal year through last September. Immigration is very policy-sensitive, Feroli cautioned, advising against extrapolating out bigger numbers beyond the end of this year. After all, policy could change after the November election, he noted. And there is a photo for this article. It is a photo of hundreds of workers with signs in a rally on January 11th in Chicago to demand that the Department of Homeland Security release renewal guidelines for the Immigrant Worker Protection Program, known as DALE, or Deferred Action for Labor Enforcement. And it is a very large group of people with their fists in the air, with some poster boards, some in different languages, demanding their rights. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 28th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Amanda Favaza from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. All right. Next, I will be reading the obituaries from today. The first is for Mary Elizabeth Rasmussen. Mary Elizabeth, maiden name Hedegaard Rasmussen, age 96, of Council Bluffs, passed away on Saturday, March 23rd of 2024. Mary was born November 14th, 1927, the sixth child of Danish immigrants Martin and Catherine Iversen Hedegaard. She is survived by her three sons, Merrill and his wife Jackie of Huxley, Iowa, Wesley of his wife Kathleen of Canton, Ohio, and Kirk and his wife Sherry of Omaha, Nebraska. She is also survived by 9 grandchildren, 24 great-grandchildren, and 4 great-great-grandchildren, plus many nieces and nephews. Mary was preceded in death by her parents, Martin and Catherine Hedegaard, 4 brothers, Emil, Alfred, Paul, Marvin, and 1 sister, Ellen Christensen. Husband Jr. of nearly 59 years, her grandson Robert J. Hurt, her daughter Linda Lay Hurt, her infant grandson Kevin Charles Hurt, and her infant great-granddaughter Lexi Serrera Hurt. Mary played piano for young people's meetings held at St. Paul's Lutheran Church near Neola, Iowa. In high school, she entered a Lutheran Brotherhood Why Do I Need Life Insurance essay contest and won a trip to Minneapolis, Minnesota. Mary graduated in 1945 from Underwood Community High School and Janine Edmondson School of Nursing in 1952. She sang in Our Savior's Lutheran Church Choir. Mary married Junior Marion Rasmussen on May 19, 1956. She spent much of her working life employed as registered nurse at Janine Edmondson Memorial Hospital, except when she stopped to care for her father to raise her preschool-age children. Mary and Junior raised their family on an acreage north of Council Bluffs she named Timberview Farm. After the children entered school, she resumed her hospital nursing career, working part-time at night. Mary attended her church's school, church or her children's school, church, sports, and 4-H and Boy Scouts events. Each summer, she drove the family car on memorable summer vacations, crisscrossing the United States. In 1980, Mary accompanied her mother-in-law, Marie Rasmussen, and her niece, Susan Rasmussen, on a once-in-a-lifetime trip to Denmark. She retired from hospital nursing and became a private duty nurse. Mary opened her home to care for her aging mother. Throughout her retirement, Mary volunteered at Janine Edmondson Memorial Hospital and joined a quilting group at Our Savior's Lutheran Church. She loved shopping at yard sales, picking up materials for layettes. Mary also attended Janine Edmondson School of Nursing alumni events and corresponded with family members in Denmark. She enjoyed seeing her granddaughter play volleyball and visiting her children's families in Missouri, Wisconsin, Kentucky, and Nebraska. After moving into Bethany Lutheran Heights with Junior in 2010, Mary started playing pool and bingo, participating in crafts and playing events, and avidly watching University of Nebraska women's volleyball. She enjoyed reading books, using her personal computer, and dining at restaurants. A memorial service will be held on Friday, March 29th, 2024, at Our Savior's Lutheran Church, 313 Story Street, Council Bluffs, beginning with a visitation at 9 a.m., funeral service at 10:30 a.m., and a luncheon following. The graveside service will be held at Boomer Township Cemetery near Neola. In lieu of flowers, a memorial contributions may be made to Our Savior Lutheran's Church. The next obituary for today is for Judith A. Vogt. Judith Ann Vogt, age 83, of Council Bluff, passed away March 25, 2024, at her home, surrounded by her loving family. Judy was born August 13, 1940, in Maryville, Missouri, to the late Fred and Helen Doherty. She graduated from Tarico, Missouri High School in 1958. Judy married William Vogt on September 13, 1959, in Council Bluffs. They were blessed with four daughters, Amy, Debbie, Patty, and Terry. Judy was a homemaker, Girl Scout leader, Sunday school teacher, blood donor, and was active with PTA. In addition to her parents, Judy was preceded in death by her daughter, Amy Marie Vogt, in 2019, brothers Ray and Keith Doherty. Judith is survived by her husband of 63 years, Bill Vogt, daughters Debbie, Patty, and Terry, 9 grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. Funeral service is on Friday at 11 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Interment at Fairview Cemetery with a lunch following at the Walnut Hill Reception Center at 1350 East Pier Street. Visitation with the family 1 hour prior to the service on Friday at the funeral home. Memorial contributions are suggested to Nebraska's animal-loving advocates at 1511 South 172nd Street, Omaha, Nebraska. All right. Our next story is from a column by Jim Nelson, and it is titled, "For Some Fans, Clark is a Bigger Deal Than Swift." They come from near and far. 10-year-old Tegan Sukalewski is a season ticket holder from Fairfax and hopes to get Kate Martin's autograph on her high tops to join the one she got from Caitlin Clark. Maddie Scaff, 10 and friend Nora Togg, 11, made the trek from Sergeant Bluff, a 4-plus-hour drive from Iowa City. Kennedy McKinnon, 8.5, tentatively stepped down the steps at Carver Hawkeye Arena with a huge, beaming smile on her face as the Taylor Swift of women's basketball, Clark, was the first one to take the floor Monday at Carver Hawkeye Arena, 90 minutes before her Iowa Hawkeyes took on West Virginia in the second round of the NCAA tournament game. There were a few amongst the hundreds that wait outside doors in line waiting to get in 2.5 hours before tip-off, a scene that had played out time and time again, home and away, for Clark and her tribe during the 2023-2024 season. It was the last appearance for Clark, the megastar, Martin, and Gabby Marshall at CHA in what certainly have been historic careers for all. Sukalewski, McMahon, Scaff, and Togg, they weren't going to miss it, nor were the hundreds of other young ladies decked out in Clark's number 22 jerseys with Hawk decals glued to their face. They held signs like the one Sukalewski made saying, "Thank you, seniors," from the next generation of girls. They screamed for her when she appeared, screamed when she left the court, and screamed for her when she made long three-pointers over and over again during the pregame, and could still be heard when the game ended with the Mountaineers started. "Caitlin got me super interested in basketball and to try a lot harder and to work harder than I would have if I ever had seen her or known who she was," Saluki said. McMahon arrived early just to watch Clark's shoot layups, short shots, and then logo threes. "It's really exciting to see how she shoot those threes. I've liked watching her shoot those threes, break that record. I will always have those memories," McMahon said. For Teg, Clark and her teammates have inspired her in many ways. She drives us to do things we don't think are possible, Teg said. She dreams big and stuff, so we do too. Her long-range shooting is amazing, but also her passion, Scaff said. And I like her passion and how she gets the ball to her teammates. That's amazing, too. McMahon, Sukulowski, Scaff, and Teg were just the lucky ones who got in Monday. The impact Clark, as well as Martin and Marshall, have made, not only in Iowa, but across the nation, is hard to quantify. But possibly inside CHA Monday, the next Clark, Martin, or Marshall was watching their every move. Or that young lady outside shooting hoops right until the 7 p.m. tip-off, right when she sprinted inside, red-faced, breathless, and excited to see the best collegiate women's basketball player in history play her last home game. And inside CHA on this night, Clark was a bigger deal than the biggest pop star in the world. Yeah, she's bigger. She is Taylor Swift of women's basketball, Sukulowski said. It is so exciting to get her autograph Saturday, and if I get Kate Martin's tonight, it will be even more exciting. Yeah, she is, smiled Scaff. And in her encore performance at CHA, Clark gave everyone a Sweet 16 present, helping deliver Iowa at a 64-54 win with a 32.8 rebound game. I think I could probably talk about them for a really long time, Clark said of her fans. I think more than anything, thank you. I'm very grateful that I got to play in an environment that supports women's athletics. They have shared a lot of special memories for myself and a journey. I've changed a lot as a person and a basketball player over the year, as a basketball player over the course of my last 4 years, and they have been a big part of that too. I think the biggest thing is just thank you. I'm forever grateful. I hope there's a lot of times when I can come back, be in the crowd at a sold-out Carver Hawkeye Arena cheering for young girls that want to be like us. Our next story today is titled Turbulent Times by David Koenig. It has been 15 years since the last fatal crash of a U.S. airliner, but you would never know that by reading about a torrent of flight problems in the past 3 months. There was a time when things like cracked windshields and minor engine problems didn't turn up very often in the news. That changed in January when a panel plugging the space reserved for an unused emergency door blew off an Alaska Airlines jetliner 16,000 feet above Oregon. Pilots landed the Boeing 737 MAX safely, but in the United States, media coverage of the flight quickly overshadowed a deadly runway crash in Tokyo 3 days earlier. And concern about air safety, especially with Boeing planes, has not let up. But is flying more dangerous? By simplest measurement, the answer is no. The last deadly crash involving a U.S. airliner occurred in February 2009, an unprecedented streak of safety. There were 9.6 million flights last year. The lack of fatal crashes did not fully capture the state of safety, however. In the past 15 months, a spate of close calls caught the attention of regulators and travelers. Another measure is the number of times pilots broadcast an emergency call to air traffic controllers. Flight Radar 24, a popular tracking site, just compiled the numbers. The site's data show such calls rising since mid-January, but remaining below levels seen during much of 2023. Emergency calls are also imperfect gauge. The plane might not have been in immediate danger, and sometimes planes in trouble never alert controllers. Safer than driving. The National Safety Council estimates that Americans have a 1 in 93 chance of dying in a motor vehicle crash, while deaths on airplanes are too rare to calculate the odds. Figures from the U.S. Department of Transportation tell a similar story. This is the safest form of transportation ever created, whereas every day on the nation's roads, about 737 full of people dies. Richard Abulfia, a longtime aerospace analyst and consultant, said, the Safety Council estimates that more than 44,000 people died in U.S. vehicle crashes in 2023. But there is a shrinking safety margin. A panel of experts reported in November that a shortage of air traffic controllers, outdated plane tracking technology, and other problems presented a growing threat to safety in the sky. The current erosion in the margin of safety in the national airspace system caused by the confluence of these challenges is rendering the current level of safety unsustainable, the group said in a 52-page report. So what is going on at Boeing? Many but not all of the recent incidents have involved Boeing planes. Boeing is a $78 billion company, a leading U.S. exporter and century-old, iconic name in aircraft manufacturing. It is one of half of the DuPont, along with Europe's Airbus, that dominates the production of large passenger jets. The company's reputation, however, was greatly damaged by crashes of two 737 MAX jets, one in Indonesia in 2018 and the other in Ethiopia the following year, that killed 346 people. Boeing has lost nearly $24 billion in the last 5 years. It has struggled with manufacturing flaws that at times delayed deliveries of 737s and long-haul 787 Dreamliners. Boeing finally was beginning to regain its stride until the Alaska Airlines MAX blowout. The investigators have focused on bolts that helped secure the door plug panel, but which were missing after a repair job at the Boeing factory. The FBI is notifying passengers about a criminal investigation. The Federal Aviation Administration is stepping up oversight of the company. What is going on with the production at Boeing? There have been issues in the past. They don't seem to be getting resolved, FAA Administrator Mike Whitaker said last month. A recent leadership shakeup at Boeing, including news March 25th that CEO David Calhoun plans to step down, highlights the difficult path facing the iconic aircraft manufacturer as it tries to navigate through a yet another safety crisis. Calhoun says that no matter what conclusion investigators reach about the Alaska Airlines blowout, Boeing is accountable for what happened on the Alaska plane. We caused that problem and we understand that. Where do design and manufacturing fit in? Problems attributed to an airplane manufacturer can differ greatly. Some are design errors. On the original Boeing MAX, the failure of single sensor caused flight control systems to point the nose of the plane down with great force, and that happened before the deadly 2018 and 2019 MAX crashes. It's a maximum in aviation that failure of a single part should never be enough to bring down a plane. In other cases, such as the door plug panel that flew off the Alaskan Airlines jet, it appears a mistake was made on the factory floor. Anything that results in death is worse, but design is a lot harder to deal with because you have to locate the problem and fix it, said Abulafia, the aerospace analysis. In the manufacturing process, the fix is incredibly easy. Don't do whatever caused the flaw in the first place. Manufacturing quality appears to be an issue in other incidents, too. In early March, the FAA proposed ordering airlines to inspect wiring bundles around the spoilers on MAX jets. The order was prompted by a report that chafing on the electrical wires due to faulty installation caused an airliner to roll 30 degrees in less than a second on a 2021 flight. Even little things matter. After an ALTAM Airlines Boeing 787 flying March 11th from Australia to New Zealand went into nosedive, it recovered. Boeing reminded airlines to inspect switches to motors that move pilot seats. Published reports said a flight attendant accidentally hitting the switch lightly caused the plunge. But not everything is Boeing's. Investigations into some incidents point to likely lapses in maintenance, and many close calls are due to errors by pilots or air traffic controllers. Investigators disclosed March 21st that an American Airlines jet that overshot a runway in Texas had undergone brake replacement job 4 days earlier, and some hydraulic lines to the brakes were not properly reattached. Earlier in March, a tire fell off a United Airlines Boeing 777, leaving San Francisco, and an American Airlines 777 made an emergency landing in Los Angeles with a flat tire. A piece of the aluminum skin was discovered missing when the United Boeing 737 landed in Oregon on March 15th. Unlike the new Alaska jet that suffered the panel blowout, the United plane was 26 years old. Maintenance is up, too, on the airline. When a FedEx cargo plane landing last year in Austin, Texas, flew close over the top of a departing Southwest Airlines jet, it turned out that the air traffic controller had cleared both planes to use the same runway. Separating serious from routine. Aviation industry officials say the most concerning events involve problems with the flight controls, engines, and structural integrity. Other things, such as cracked windshields and plane clippings each other at the airport, rarely pose a safety threat. Warning lights might indicate a serious problem or false alarm. We take every event seriously, former NTSB member John Goliga said, citing such vigilance as a contributor to the current crash-free streak. The challenge we have in aviation is to try to keep it there. There are two images for this story. One is a damaged car in an airport parking lot March 7th after debris from a tire that fell from a Boeing 777 landed on it at San Francisco International Airport. It is a car that has its windshield blown out and looks basically totaled. And another photo is of the door plug area on an Alaska Airlines Boeing 737 MAX 9 with the paneling removed. And it was shown prior to inspection on January 10th. At the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport in Washington. So it is the emergency exit of an airplane, but it has like the wall and paneling removed. All right, for this next story, we're going to talk about basketball, and it's titled Cyclones Look to Keep It in the Run Rolling in Boston for the Sweet 16 by Austin Heinen. For the second time in 3 years and the seventh time in program history, the Iowa State men's basketball team clinched a spot in the Sweet 16 round of the NCAA tournament. Despite an ice-cold start from the offense, the Cyclones rallied back to top number 7 Washington State 67-56 in the round 32 in Omaha after trailing by much as 8 midway through the first half before an 11-2 run pulled the Cyclones back in the contest. Nonetheless, ISU still had work to do in the second half after being tied 27-27 with the Cougars, who were 21-0 on the season when tied or leading a game at halftime before this game. As Cyclones fans saw numerous times before, the Cyclones used their defense to kickstart the offense in the second half. I think it was more what we did upping our aggressiveness on the defensive ends, senior forward Trey King said. In the first half, we were a little tentative, and we knew they were to play out of the skip. And I think early in the game, we were too worried about that and not focused on what we do well, which is turning people over. So in the second half, we regrouped and talked about how we only forced 5 turnovers and how that's unacceptable to us and how we were going to, quite frankly, just triple it like we normally do. So credit to our guys on maintaining the focus and really upping the aggressive, especially in the ball screen and forcing the big turnovers in key moments, he said. Obviously, our shots weren't falling from the perimeter to start that game. We were locked in defensively, trying to take our minds off the offensive, let that come to us, and just stay aggressive like we did, sophomore guard Tamlin Lipsy said. The Cyclones found a way to win, a little ugly, but nonetheless win. The win, TJ Otzelberger became the first Iowa State coach to send the Cyclones to the Sweet 16 multiple times in one tenure. As great as the feeling is, and to do it at a place that means so much to Otzelberger is humbling, but it's far from a one-man turnaround. You know, it's obviously a tremendous honor to lead this program, Cyclones coach TJ Otzelberger said. You look at our fans and the support we have. I feel like I've grown up in coaching at Iowa State, so it means that so much to me and to my family, it's truly an honor. I got one of my best friends on the planet right now here to be on this journey with him as our athletics director, Otzelberger said. The awesome support we have from our administration, our fans, and those who have come before us, I mean, man, it's a pretty awesome experience. So credit to our guys. They're the ones doing the hard work every single day, and certainly thankful for them, but very humbling experience for sure. The Cyclones now turn their attention to the Big Ten tournament champion, Illinois, who defeated number 14 Morehead State and Duquesne with some big offensive performances in doing so. The Illini have scored 85 points or more in the last 4 games. However, going up against some of the nation's best defensive teams has not typically treated the Illini well, as they're just 2-6 atop 20 statistical defenses and 1-5 against top 25 ranked teams. Iowa State, who ranks number 2 overall defensively behind South Region's number 1 Houston. After having the chance to scout Illinois immediately after their round of 32 win, Otzelberger and the Cyclones feel like they have a winning plan to slow down the Illini's high-powered offense. I would just say we believe in the way or in our way of doing things, Otzelberger said. We certainly want to be aware of tendencies our opponents and things we can prepare for it and be disruptive, but we spend a lot more time focusing on us being the best version of ourselves. So we will absolutely be very mindful of that opportunity, and at the same time, my message to our guys is going to be to continue to focus on us and being the best team that we can be. We've had great focus that way, and I feel really confident in our group as we do that. Iowa State and Illinois will tip off at approximately 9:09 p.m., and the game will be televised on TBS and True TV. This next article is regarding higher education, and it is titled, "Is the SAT Making a Comeback?" by Maddie Aiken. More colleges require test scores, but fairness remains a concern. Are the SATs the newest fad to come back to school? Colleges such as Dartmouth, Brown, and Yale have reinstated their standardized test score requirements. A new, digitized version of the SAT is shorter and aims to improve the test-taking experience. But questions remain over whether universities should require SAT and ACT scores as pandemic-induced test optional policies reach their expiration dates. Upward of 80% of colleges and universities are remaining test optional through fall 2025, according to Fair Test, an educational nonprofit that advocates for fairness and accuracy in student test taking. As colleges navigate 2026 and beyond, Fair Test Executive Director Harry Fetter believes it's important for schools to both examine their internal data and listen to their students. Different data regarding the effectiveness and fairness of standardized testing requirements can be contradicting. On one end, a 2020 study by researchers at the University of Chicago found that students' high school grade point averages were 5 times stronger than ACT scores at predicting college graduation. And a 2022 study by the University of Pennsylvania found that standardized test scores were positively correlated with family income at 2 times the rate of high school GPA. Fetter of Fair Test believes that data like these demonstrate that test scores aren't the best measure of a student's success. He said high school GPAs are most are the most reliable predictor of student success. He also believes more schools should implement performance assessments to determine if an applicant would be a good fit for his intended major. There are other ways, better ways, that students can demonstrate that they would be a good fit for a university, Fetter said. But other students maintain that SAT and ACT scores are equal or better predictors of student success. A 2020 report by the University of California Academic Council found that in the University of California system, test scores were better at predicting freshman GPA than high school GPA was. Test scores were about as good as predicting first-year retention, undergraduate GPA, and graduation, the same study reports. In a January study conducted through Harvard University found that at IB Plus colleges, students with higher test scores were more likely to have higher college GPAs, even when considering socioeconomic background. The study examined 2017 to 2022 data as the eight Ivy League colleges, as well as Stanford University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Duke University, and the University of Chicago. The same study concluded that high school GPA did little to predict collegiate academic success at elite institutions. John Freeman, an economics professor at Brown University who co-authored the study, said he believes that study demonstrates that SAT and ACT scores are a helpful tool for admissions officers to identify high potential students from less well-resourced backgrounds. SAT-ACT scores offer important information regarding students' academic preparedness, Freeman says. A complementary study of mine from last summer shows that SAT and ACT scores also predict post-college outcomes, including earnings, attendance at elite graduate programs, and employment at prestigious firms. He added it's important for school leaders to study the effectiveness of test scores predictions at their own campuses. As far as the College Board is concerned, the SAT will remain a vital player in a holistic admissions process. The College Board is the nonprofit organization that administers the SAT. Priscilla Rodriguez, College Board's Senior Vice President of College Readiness Assessment, said in a statement that test scores can bolster students' academic profiles as they apply to schools. She pointed to a 2022 survey commissioned by College Board that found 4 in 5 students and parents want the option to submit test scores. That is because the SAT allows students, regardless of where they go to high school, to be seen by colleges and scholarship providers, Rodriguez wrote. In the class of 2023, nearly 1.3 million U.S. students had SAT scores that affirmed or exceeded their high school GPA. That means their SAT scores were a point of strength on their college applications. All right, our final story for the day is titled What's Next for the Speaker? It's about Congress and is by Franoush Amiri of the Associated Press. Barely 6 months into the job, House Speaker Mike Johnson is already at risk of the same conservative revolt that took down his predecessor. The Louisiana Republican, who took the gavel in October after weeks of GOP infighting, was put on warning by one of his harshest critics in March 22nd after he helped push through a $1.2 trillion spending package with the majority Democratic votes despite heavy criticism from his right flank. During the vote, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a resolution with House Clerk called a motion to vacate that removed Johnson from the Speaker's position if approved by the House. While Greene did not force the resolution to be taken up immediately, she told reporters she was laying the groundwork for consideration once the House returns from recess April 8th. It's more of a warning, Greene said. She added, "We've started the clock to start the process to elect a new Speaker. So here's what to know. What is a motion to vacate? The rules of the House allow any single lawmaker to make a motion to vacate the chair, essentially a vote to oust the Speaker through a privilege resolution. The motion was never deployed successfully until last October when a rebel band of Republicans joined with Democrats to oust then Representative Kevin McCarthy as Speaker. Proponents of allowing a single lawmaker to file the motion said it promotes accountability, noting its long history in the House. Then Representative Mark Meadows used the tool in 2015 against then-Speaker John Boehner. 2 months later, Boehner announced he would step down. So how does it work? A member of the House can introduce a privilege resolution, a designation that gives it a priority over other measures, to declare the office of the Speaker of the House vacant. The lawmaker can then request a vote, forcing House leaders to schedule a vote on the resolution within 2 legislative days. There are procedural motions members of either party could use to slow or stop process. If a resolution comes to the floor for a vote, it would take a simple majority of the House, 218 votes when no seats are vacant, to remove the Speaker, as it happened to McCarthy in a 216-210 vote. So who is trying to oust Johnson and why? The most extreme members of his party accused McCarthy being too moderate, including when he worked across the aisle last year to fund the government and raise the nation's debt limit. Republicans unanimously chose Johnson to replace McCarthy after several candidates for the job failed to gain enough support. Green, a McCarthy ally, has been skeptical of Johnson's speakership. She criticized her fellow far-right colleagues for toppling McCarthy and warned Johnson she would try to remove him in a similar fashion if he were to push ahead with a package to support Ukraine as it battles Russia's invasion. Meanwhile, supporters of Ukraine are increasingly frustrated with delays in the House, especially as Kyiv's troops run low on ammunition. Some Republicans have been working to craft a package or circumvent the Speaker's control over what bills get brought to the floor. Johnson so far refused to put a $95 billion Senate-passed national security package with Ukraine funding to a House vote, but promised funding Ukraine is the next priority now that government funding is resolved. The removal threats put Ukraine aid in potential jeopardy and could empower Democrats to make demands, since their votes might be needed to save his job. Does the motion have the votes to pass? It's unclear what support Green's resolution would have in a vote. Many Republicans in Congress were embarrassed by McCarthy's removal as Speaker, which left their new majority unable to function for 3 weeks. I don't think it's the right time, Representative Tim Burchett said. He added that another attempt to remove a GOP Speaker could result in a win for the Democrats. If we did it right now, we elect Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries as Speaker. When I vacated the last one, I made a promise to the country that we would not end up with a Democratic Speaker. I couldn't make that promise today, said Representative Matt Gaetz, who introduced the motion to oust McCarthy. If Johnson is ousted, what would happen next? The Speaker of the House is required to write a list of individuals who can act as Speaker pro tempore, which would be made public if the speakership is vacated. The first person on that list would be named Speaker pro tempore, and their first order of business would be to hold an election for a new speaker as many times as it takes for a candidate to receive a majority of votes. All right, and that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 28th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Amanda from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.